Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Podcast, episode 56.
Ha, sip, ho. That's Ty.
Hey, everybody.
Hi.
How was your new year? Did you celebrate? You stayed until midnight?
Pop some bottles of champagne.
Pop, pop. We stayed up till midnight. We stayed up till like 1.
We did.
Which is not bad. We were in Thailand, so we had our celebration 12 hours before everybody else did.
12 hours ahead, yeah. They had a whole, the place where we were staying had a whole celebration planned, and it was going great. And then it started raining right before the fireworks. So I guess only about, you know, a tenth of the actual fireworks they had went off.
I'd say Lindsay and I just did a trip to Southeast Asia, and we were in Thailand and Cambodia. And my biggest regret from the trip actually is that we didn't get tickets early enough to this Cambodian circus called Phare Circus, P-H-A-R-E. We were like, oh yeah, we'll get tickets when we get there. We were in Cambodia for like 3 days. First day we were there, like, let's get tickets, go to the hotel concierge. Sold out for like 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's great that Cambodian circus is crushing it. The Phare Circus sort of seems like maybe Midnight Circus or Circus Marcus, where it takes like kids, teaches them.
Yeah, and then they said they're like 20-year-olds though.
Yeah, so like maybe 20 to 30. So maybe more like midnight in the age range. But yeah, it's a good new year.
They have a lot of marketing as far as like, you know, the town we were in is Siem Reap, and it's not big. But for as small as it was, there was a lot of marketing for the circus show.
I think it's the number one attraction, like, show to do when you're in Siem Reap is to go
see Phare
Circus.
Sold out.
It's in a tent. It's a cool vibe. But I'm ready for 2018. This is going to be a new, fresh year with some fresh news.
I mean, I guess we're talking about news that did happen technically prior to us leaving, but we were gone for 3 weeks. So now we're back and a lot to catch up on.
Yes. Yeah, so maybe we start with some news coming out of Vegas that, you know, we'll take credit for predicting 6 months ago.
Did we predict it? I don't remember.
I think maybe we did. But
the maybe
show,
in your mind.
Circus 1903, which we talked about before, it's a theater circus show. The theme is 1903.
Well, very much a title on the nose of what the show is.
Yes, it is. It's a good explainer.
Yeah. No, not much marketing needed.
We saw the show in New York. We sort of had mixed feelings about it. We talked about it on the podcast. Then they opened it in Vegas 2 weeks before Misbehave Game Show, one of our shows there, opened. And Misbehave is still going. Circus 1903 closed. They cited not good enough ticket sales in Vegas, but they are going to continue with their world tour because they do sell well in regional markets over a shorter period of time, even though they couldn't make it work in Las Vegas.
I guess that is something we said. Like, how is this... This is a real family show. Is it going to fare well in Vegas? And the answer is no.
And how do you compete against Cirque du Soleil? Like, they got...
And then the circus wasn't... I mean, I'm sure individually the performers are good, but as a whole, the circus wasn't very enthralling. Mm. And for a show that's called Circus 1903, and then you're up against these circus shows, which are just insane, and it doesn't feel like...
It's not a point of difference enough.
Yes, exactly. One thing that the article about Circus 1903 closing said, they quoted the ringmaster, you know, character.
Yeah, he's a magician, right?
Yeah, I guess he's like a magician and has toured with Disney cruises and is really good with kids, which is why they wanted him to be in the show. But that to me was like, what? You think, where are all these kids coming from to see this show in Vegas? Mm. Whenever we're there, it's always like 20-year-olds and up.
It's hard to go because, you know, it's all about gambling. And if you're not 18 or whatever to gamble, it's an expensive trip to bring your kids on.
So expensive. And you have to just like skedaddle through the
strip.
No. Where do you gamble? The casino
floor.
There you go. That word.
Clearly you're a big gambler.
I'm a massive gambler. But so anyway, they're going on their world tour, which they'll probably do a lot better.
Hmm. Speaking of people who are making gambles. Showbiz Dave, who's that's his website. This guy Dave got a great circus blog going on. Had a really interesting article back in the last week of December talking about the health of a few shows. One brief thing that he said that I thought was interesting was that Circus Vargas says they're doing worse now that Ringling isn't there. Because I guess when Circus Vargas was in the same market as Ringling, and Ringling was doing a lot of marketing, that actually helped boost Circus Vargas's ticket sales. Which sort of seems to indicate that you know, more shows in a single market help one another because people are seeing ads for Circus. So if they don't go see Ringling, they'll see another show or vice versa. But interesting impact. A year later, you know, from the announcement, basically, that Ringling was going to close. Came out of nowhere.
Yeah, I think people overestimate the public's awareness of Circus and what's happening. And I think people think, well, they'll know that Ringling closed and know that our Circus is a different Circus, but I don't think people do. And I think that's also what's currently hindering the Big Apple Circus, which is also mentioned in that article.
Yeah, why don't you jump into that?
Well, as we all know, maybe we don't know, but recap, quick recap, the Big Apple Circus, the nonprofit circus, went into bankruptcy a little over a year ago, citing ticket sales and no more corporate buyouts as the reason they were in the hole from 2008. This guy, Neil, plus a few other business partners, decided to buy the Big Apple Circus from bankruptcy and turn it into a for-profit commercial entity and brought it back. Same location, same tent,
same director.
Many of the same acts. A lot of the same acts, a slightly different logo, and slightly new marketing. I got so many texts from people, and they were like, wait, the Big Apple's back? I thought it was closed. Or it's like, oh, wow, they're back. I didn't even know they weren't back, you know? And I think the overestimation of people knowing what's going on with the circus is what really killed the ticket sales, because it was also like, Big Apple's back. And a lot of people are like, where did it go? You know, or it's like back and new. And it's like, why did it, how did it change? And people who weren't going to see Big Apple before aren't going to see Big Apple now.
I mean, do we know that for sure, though?
That's my speculation.
I think what's interesting is hard to say how it did in New York. You know, we don't have the ticket data. We saw a few shows. We got friends in the show. So we've heard that it wasn't, you know, a consistently sold out house. We'll put it that way. They had a lot of performances, like 12 a week, many of them early. I think probably the weekends, the better 4 o'clock times, matinee times sold well. But I don't think they really crushed it in the way maybe they had hoped,
right,
ticket sale wise in New York. Maybe not enough where it's a problem, but definitely not enough where it was a huge sold out hit. And that sort of now transitions into them going on tour, which is coming up at the end of this month. First, they're going to Atlanta, but not exactly the city of Atlanta. This town that's 26 miles outside of Atlanta called Alfreda.
Wait, is it Alfreda? I always think it sounds like a pasta dish.
Yeah, it's Alfredo rigatoni or something. No, but it's Alfreda, I think is how you say it.
I think you're right.
And they're going to the Verizon amphitheater, which is not really a stadium. It's like an outdoor amphitheater. Seats about 10,000 people. But
Alpharetta.
Ooh, Alpharetta. Okay.
Alpharetta, with a population of around 63,000 people.
And they're going to go up in a tent in a parking lot there, playing for, I believe, 4.5 weeks, doing the same 12 to 13 performances a week kind of schedule. And just mathematically, throwing some math out there, that means that there are more tickets to be sold in Alpharetta than
Alpharetta,
then there is a population in Alpharetta. It's like 72 or 73,000 tickets they need to sell if they were going to sell all their tickets, but it's a population of like 63,000 in that town. So they're really depending on people coming in from all these different suburbs in Atlanta to come and see Big Apple.
So I don't obviously know Alpharetta intimately, but if it's anything like Boston, the suburbs of Boston, it's a stadium. People are used to going there from the surrounding area.
But it's not a stadium. It's an amphitheater. I do want to make a difference because the sports team doesn't play there. You know,
no, but people are used to going to an amphitheater for a concert, or, you know, like it's a venue that sells tickets and people are used to going.
Yes.
So in that sense, I understand why they would go to a place like that.
Cirque du Soleil does that all the time.
Right. And maybe it's better to be like the big thing, the only thing in the town versus, you know, something here in New York where you're essentially the same size as a Broadway theater house and you're competing against, you know, 40 other theaters.
Sure. I mean, I think you and I can go into ages, the pros of like a sit down versus a tour and how big the markets are. But I think what's an interesting question that I'll pose to you now is, do you think being 26 miles away from downtown Atlanta and being in this smaller town that they'll be able to get people from other suburbs to come to the show and from the city to come to the show? Or do you think it's going to be a struggle to sell tickets?
Pessimistically, I think it's going to be hard to sell tickets. I think I think New York is a really good marker of interest. You know, you have a very big arts going group of people who live in New York. But at the same time, I could talk myself out of that view because, you know, circus is historically a more lowbrow art form and it feels more populous and for more people. And people in New York typically are a little bit more snooty and highbrow with their art they choose to go see and buy tickets to. So maybe being in a smaller town is actually the right choice for Big Apple. And that's actually where they should be versus a big metropolitan area where people maybe don't find the value in paying for a $140 ticket to go see a circus.
Mm. I think they're going to D.C. afterwards, and I believe there's a Cirque du Soleil show playing at the same time in D.C. that they're planning to play. So, you know, once we hear about how Atlanta goes, any information we get out of our, you know, friends there, we'll update you on, and when they get to Washington, D.C., we'll do some more speculation.
The only thing I just, like, don't agree with, and I feel like they shouldn't be going out with offering so many shows. I feel like you should dwindle down the supply of your shows and then see how they're selling. And then if they're selling well, then you can open up the additional shows.
Yes, I agree. I mean, I think 4 weeks is a long time to play any market. That's about the length Cirque du Soleil goes to play a market. I do understand that you need to be there long enough to get press coverage. And I do understand that you want to minimize how many times you jump, because every time you go to a new site, that costs money and you're not selling tickets when you're jumping. But I agree. I think probably 12 shows a week is too many shows a week, particularly in a market they haven't been to in a while, to a new place. But, you know, I do wish them the best of luck. I want Big Apple to come back next year. We're rooting for them. See what happens.
You know, jumping back to Circus 1903 for a minute.
Yeah.
They said on their tour route, they were in markets for a week and they would sell out. So I think it'll be interesting to see how a 4 week run in a place does.
They had the benefit of going to theaters, so they don't have to bring this massive tent structure with them.
But still, I think they're playing similar size places.
Yeah.
And, you know, the shows probably cost similar amounts.
Sure. Speaking of other fun news and people who were at one point loosely affiliated with the Big Apple Circus, Hovey Burgess, the famous circus instructor, he's come up on many podcast guest interviews as an influence of loads and loads of Americans after... Did you remember how many years he was teaching at NYU for?
Since 1966.
So he's been teaching actors at NYU circus skills since 1966.
100 semesters.
So that's 2 semesters a year, 100 semesters. Pretty crazy. He just finished his last semester. I believe it wrapped up this past week. Hovey had a nice article written about him in the New Yorker, sort of profiling his class and what was being taught in it. But pretty amazing accomplishment, I gotta say. This dude has, as far as New York goes, taught tons and tons of people. We're still hoping to have him on the podcast. I've been lobbying him for like a year, but I don't think podcasting is his go-to form of entertainment.
Maybe now that he's not teaching, he'll have more free time to do a podcast.
I hope so. If you're best buds with Hovey Burgess and you're sitting there with him listening to this, prod him to come on the air.
Yeah, he's pretty amazing. He's 77, still teaching, or I guess just retired, you know. But he was in Circus Flora last year.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a good transition, actually, to Circus Flora news, too.
Yeah. Hovey was the bridge between Big Apple and Circus Flora. I guess if you're around that long, you've worked in almost every circus.
I mean, it definitely seems that way.
I think he started when he was, like, 17. I think he ran away with a traveling circus, like, classic nostalgic way of joining the circus. I still wish that happened.
I think it sort of does. Maybe not in New York City, but parts of the world.
Yeah. So anyway, Circus Flora
finally has a permanent home. Their tent was bought by I think it's the Kratzenberg Foundation. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. But a nonprofit organization purchased the tent and helped organize a new site for them. The tent will be up for 9 months of the year. Previously, I think it was just up for 2 months. Mm-hmm. What this means for them is that they'll be able to do the show a little bit earlier in the season. I think maybe starting in late March or April as opposed to May or July.
Kratzenberg Arts Foundation.
Mm-hmm. And when Flora is not happening, the tent will be used for other kinds of arts and events performances. So trying to make that venue more of a permanent venue.
And the venue will be called the Big Top.
That's not a bad name.
No, it's not. I think it's really smart, actually, because if you're if you're only in season 2 months of the entire year, like, I just don't know how you can sustain or be profitable. But if your venue's open and you can rent it out for shows, for, you know, concerts, for parties, you know, that makes a lot of sense.
I would point out, though, that Florida is a nonprofit, so their goal is not necessarily to be profitable.
Right, but and we saw Big Apple, a not-for-profit, whose goal wasn't to be profitable, and they closed.
Sure, but they also don't own their venue, so presumably any rent that is charged during not the Florida season will go to the Kratzenberg Arts Foundation.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Yeah, I agree.
Sorry, I was yawning. I'm still a little bit jet-lagged, but hanging in there.
Oh, yeah. 5 days later. 6 days later.
No, we got back Friday night.
Well, we'll see when this gets published, but it's like the 5th, maybe?
Today? You think today is the 5th?
No, we got back on the 5th.
Oh, yeah. I was like, today's the 10th.
Yeah, we got stuck in all... If anybody was reading the news and saw, like, how terrible JFK was, we got totally stuck in the middle of that JFK mess.
Well, we got diverted from our flight to Hong Kong mid-flight to Vancouver. And then we flew to JFK and sat on the
11-hour delay in Vancouver.
Yes, 11-hour delay in Vancouver. Then we finally get to JFK, where we wait on the runway for 2.5 hours. Then we get to the gate, and no one is there to let us off the plane.
So that goes another 30 minutes.
Then we try to get our bags, which takes how long, Josh?
2.5 hours.
So all in all, we had it not as bad as most people, but it was the worst.
Not a great travel day.
Not a great travel day.
So for most of today's episode, we're going to be talking about Cirque du Soleil. In a little bit, we're going to be calling up our friend we met at business school who's been advising us in how to run Hideaway since we started. We'll intro him more in a bit to talk about how Cirque du Soleil is really doing. We got a little bit of a tip-off from... we can't say who our source is. I know, you know, it's bad form to not name who says stuff like this. But we'll say from somebody who runs and owns a circus company... that's well known, told us that they know that Cirque du Soleil might not be doing so good.
They also alluded that TPG, the Texas-based investment firm, and Fossen, the China-based company, are looking to maybe offload Cirque du Soleil.
So we're going to ask Brett later about why they would do that, why they would buy Cirque in the first place, how do you make money if you're TPG or Fossen, what their goals might actually be. But first, we're going to talk about some more general Cirque news just to set up some basic background.
Yeah, let's talk about the ecosystem currently of Cirque du Soleil.
Well, one of the new things is the NFL experience in Times Square.
Which we did.
And as you know, Cirque du Soleil this year, so they're no longer just a circus company. They're an entertainment media group. So presumably they'll be making more things like the NFL experience. Lindsay, what did you think of the NFL experience?
Oh my God, guys, I absolutely hated it. Like, I can't even sugarcoat it. I was miserable the whole time. And I like football, not a massive fan, but I like football. And I was so effing bored. I was so bored. I can't even say one good thing. Oh, other than that I can throw a football.
Well, so let's bring people what happens to it. I didn't hate it as much as Lindsay. I'm a real diehard Patriots fan, so it was fun seeing some of the Patriots elements. But
let's start. Hold on. Let's start at the beginning. How much is a ticket, Josh?
I think we went during the daytime. I think it's $45 and maybe at night it's $65.
$45 effing dollars for this stupid, stupid experience. And then you go up. First of all, you enter this lobby that you're like, wait, Cirque du Soleil, NFL, you have so much money. This is what the entrance to your experience looks like. It's concrete with like NFL experience written on the wall. And then you go to the holding area where there's memorabilia of all the teams. And the size of the memorabilia is like 3 feet wide.
Yeah, it's like 10 items per team. And, you know, as somebody who's like a Patriots fan, I'm like, oh, man, it'd be super cool to see a ring or a Tom Brady jersey or just like things that are cool. Basically, everything in these were pretty lame. Like the actual memorabilia they had, I was like, really, that's the memorabilia? Like,
it was so bad. And we got there right when it opened. And so their first thing is that you see this, I don't know, 17-minute video. And it was broken. So we had to wait for the video to start. in this lame ass room.
This lobby area, sort of.
And then we go in to see this stupid video that's 17 minutes.
Can you guys get a sense of how much Lizzie disliked it? It wasn't that stupid. I mean, the...
Josh, it was supposed to be like a ride-ish.
Yes. So it's a movie theater auditorium. Maybe it's got 150, 200 seats in it. All of the seats have haptic feedback in it. Haptic means like it shakes and can shake in different parts. And then
it moves forward and back.
It moves forward and can tilt, exactly. So sort of like a simulator kind of ride you might see at Universal or Disney. Then there's also a movie screen, but also like white walls around the movie screen. So they sort of do not even 180 degrees of projection, but maybe like 120 degrees of projection around you a little bit, sort of. But the shape of the room is very strange and very, very angular. So it doesn't, it's not like being in a dome or something where it's very smooth, the screen, and you can't really see where the edges are. This is like a very edgy, weird polygon shape of a room, which just made like the screens and the projectors very strange. They blow a ton of soap bubbles on you at one point. Oh my god,
because it's snowing, and then they blow soap on you, and if you get it in your eye, it hurts.
I mean, that's soap, right?
But why are they putting all this soap on? Like, oh god.
And if you're like super into the NFL, like me, or specifically like a team, you probably follow on YouTube or know this channel called like Sights and Sounds, which is like every week, all the games, they put up like not really game footage, but like footage from the sidelines of like plays and players talking and coaches talking. So you get that sort of like, I don't know, experience of what it's like to be on the sideline as opposed to just watching the game. And it was essentially a 17-minute version of that is posted every week to YouTube and on
probably better to watch on YouTube.
And then, like, every time somebody got tackled, like, the chair shook. And pretty violently.
It like, kind of hurt. And they were like, you can turn your intensity on your chair down. And then you turn it down because I was like, oh, this is kind of, like, whiplashing me. And it's still bad. It's still, like, even on the lowest setting, it was kind of an intense... In not a good way.
No.
Then after the video, you're like, okay, great. That was just the opening. Like, I'm sure the experience now that we're going to get actually into it is going to be a lot better.
So the next part, you go out of the video, you go down one floor. This whole thing takes up like four floors of a building. So you walk in the ground floor and you go to an elevator to the fourth floor.
We're going to the locker room. That's what they're...
But the fourth floor where you go first up the elevator is like the memorabilia section. Then you go into the movie theater. The movie theater sort of takes up floor four and three. So you exit on the bottom, the third floor, and it's like... Yeah, it sort of looks like a locker room, but sort of not like... Oh, everything sort of feels half-assed as far as the decoration and the design of the space. And there's four different exercises that you can try. And these are all things that you would see in the NFL Combine, which is every year before NFL players get drafted, everybody has to like run as fast as they can and jump as high as they can and like push as hard as they can. And all gets measured so that talent scouts can be like, that dude runs faster and that guy jumps higher. So you do like, how high can you jump? And like, how hard can you push into like, pads to see like, would you be a good lineman?
So those are the first two, the jumping and the pushing of the pads, which I decided to... video Josh doing and not participate.
Yeah, you can see it on my Instagram at Josh.
You did a pretty good job.
I did. I mean, I didn't jump nearly as high as anybody.
No, but for your 5'7" frame, you did a very good job.
Well, thanks. You can watch my jump on my Instagram. And then they have you throw footballs into like a TV screen with a net in front of it.
You're supposed to be throwing to the, like, you're the quarterback and you're throwing to who's ever catching it.
Yes.
And I have to say, I got a very good score because it was so inaccurate.
Yeah, so long as you threw it
forward. As long as you threw it, you pretty much got a good score.
And then they had another thing where, like, you put your head, like, super close to a TV screen that is, like, in a helmet. And you have John Gruden, who is was a coach and then became an NFL broadcaster and is now going to be a coach again next year for the Raiders, like, explain to you how NFL plays work. Which, I guess, if you don't know anything about football, is, like, a decent intro discussion. But if you play Madden or you watch the game, like...
But Josh, I don't know any of the plays, and that was soul-crushingly boring for me to stand in.
Well, it was boring because they didn't have you do anything. They had you, like, press a button of, like, when to throw the ball so it doesn't get intercepted. But it wasn't... That didn't really feel like a challenge to it.
No.
So it was sort of just, like, more kind of weird video footage that wasn't super compelling.
Right.
So you go through that experience. That took us about, I don't know, 15 minutes.
Yeah.
So we've had... Waiting, doing nothing for 20 minutes, annoying 15-minute video, okay, like 15-minute, like immersive-ish,
yeah.
Low-tech, sort of not low-tech experiences, and then you go down to the second floor, and all of a sudden you're in like a room with a ceiling height that's like 7 feet, maybe.
Yeah, it's low
ceiling. But the whole ceiling is covered in like confetti, trying to make it look like
you just won the Super Bowl.
You just won the Super Bowl, but it just looks like you're in a room with a low ceiling with confetti hanging from the ceiling.
Yeah, and there's like a weird printed carpet that has confetti printed on it, so it looks like you're just like walking on confetti, but you're walking on a weird carpet. And the Patriots are the ones who they chose to win the Super Bowl. So I was like, oh, well, that's cool. It's our team. And we went to go take a photograph with, like, I don't know, like a mannequin.
And like a green screen.
Yeah. And then this dude came over to us who I think I was noticing him. I think he was probably like
a manager
or someone important as part of this NFL experience. And he came over and was like, how did you like this? Do you want me to take your photo? And I was like, yeah, sure. And he asked how we liked it and or what our favorite part was. He didn't ask if we liked it. He said, what was your favorite part of the experience? And I said, the part where we actually got to throw a football. Because it's true. That was the only interesting part where you actually got to throw a game-sized football because they're massive. But I wouldn't say...
But you could go to, like, the local sports authority and right. Do that in the store.
Yeah, and then they had, like, two, like, photo ops where you stood in front of the green screen where it looked like Gatorade was being poured on you. And I'm like, they have that on a Snapchat filter. That's a lot better.
Yeah, and they cost like $20 or whatever afterwards to go like buy that photo.
Oh, $20 to buy a stupid photo. It was because I asked. Because I was like, well, it was a bad photo. So I was like, that could be funny to have in our fridge. Mm. So how much is it? $20. No way. And then they, of course, have you exit through a souvenir store, which doesn't even have any good
souvenirs, things. Really.
You think if it's an NFL store... With the Cirque maybe merchandising
skills,
it would be good, but it's not.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest. Cirque look is at the top of the game of merch. I used to buy like stuff at the Cirque
merchandise all the time. Yeah, their programs are awesome.
Programs, generally speaking, interesting fashion-ish choices for the clothing. You might not like them out of fashion, but they're real choices they made. It's more than just a printed T-shirt.
That's true. That's true.
They used to sell masks. They had cool stuff. This store, I was like, meh, sort of feels like you're going to. You know, a sports authority or something. You know?
But we got through the entire experience in 40 minutes because it would have been quicker if the screen hadn't broken.
But it was pretty quick because literally no one was there.
No one was there.
We did it with maybe one person and a child.
And it didn't even seem like the children were having a good time.
No, he was like, when's the movie starting?
I mean, honestly, I was so let down because I do like football. You love football. And like... How cool is it that the NFL and a circus company, you know,
merged forces.
And you'd think that it would be sweet.
It just didn't seem like they really cared about thought into it.
It's so bad.
All right. We've done enough complaining about the NFL experience. Let's talk about some other Cirque stuff in the news. So a few other things to take into account about Cirque du Soleil right now. They've just closed two shows. So one show they closed was Criss Angel in Las Vegas. I believe that had its final performance sometime earlier this month, like early January. And that show has an interesting history. It got like remade 3 or 4 times with progressively less and less Cirque du Soleil stuff. So it opened originally, I think, maybe even 10 years ago at the Luxor, which is the pyramid-looking hotel in Las Vegas. And it had a much bigger cast, a lot of dance in it. Everybody was dressed up as rabbits. And then a bunch of that got cut because I think A, it was expensive, and B, not very good. And then they did another version of it with more of Chris's stuff.
Yeah, the final show took place on October 28th.
Oh, so not even last, like 3 months ago.
We're late on this one, but it's still applicable to
topical.
To the, yeah.
And they did another version for people who'd seen it before with like new tricks in it. The highlight for me of this show was they had a really cool dove effect where like, I don't know, a couple dozen doves flew from the stage over the audience to the back of the theater. But not one of my favorite circus shows or magic shows, to be totally honest. So one less show in Las Vegas. Another show.
La Nuba in Orlando, which I think has been there for over 10 years as well. I saw it when I went to school in Tampa.
That was the show that Trampoline Wall was popularized at, for those who like Trampoline Wall.
Yeah, it's a really good act. But La Nuba closed maybe last year?
Nope, it closed. It closed last year, exactly, on the 31st.
Yeah.
It's the last performance in the last day of the year.
And they are planning on putting a new show in, Cirque du Soleil, with Disney. They haven't said what the show is yet.
They actually have since I sent you that article. They have announced a little bit more, and it's going to be about the history of animation.
Oh, right. Which sounds really cool.
Well, so here's the question. Why would Cirque do a history of animation? What two shows do they have tons of props and costumes and set pieces that are all to do with the movie business and animation?
Oh, Paramore.
And prior to that, Iris.
Iris.
So, oh, right. Iris didn't do really well in the Kodak, you know, but they had all this stuff. They spent like over $100 million on it. I mean, the Kodak Theater in L.A., only there for like 9 months.
Yeah.
Then they used like half the set and costumes on that for Paramore. That was only there for a year. I assume if it's going to be movie themed, if it's going to be animation themed, they're going to use all their movie based.
But it's probably going to be more interesting because using the Disney properties is always
interesting. Didn't say they're going to use Disney properties. So they're going to talk about the history of animation. So obviously Mickey Mouse is a huge part of the history of animation.
Well, Walt Disney.
Walt Disney and Mickey Mouse, the character, and
Mortimer Mouse, actually.
Whoa, Mortimer Mouse originally.
But if you read the history of Disney's animation, it's so interesting, and like the animators' lives and like how they worked, and that would be an amazing show. But
NFL is super interesting of how football the game was, you know, came to be. Yeah. Subject material is one thing, but the execution is another, and we've already seen all these props and sets and costumes in these other shows, which tourists in Disney might not have seen. But overall, like, maybe the shows didn't do well because the look and vibe wasn't that interesting. I mean, what is a Cirque du Soleil show if it's not the look and the vibe?
It's true. I mean, even their Broadway show, which you could divert a little bit from your classic image of how you do costumes and everything, still looked like Cirque du Soleil.
Yes.
Yes.
So let's talk about Cirque du Soleil this last year. Show on Broadway didn't do well. Definitely a loss. Not a huge one, but
definitely not a huge one because they did get paid to leave.
Yes, but surely a loss of at least a few million dollars. NFL experience, jury's still out, but if it's anything like, you know, what it was like when we went there, the puppy ain't gonna last that long. Closing shows in Vegas, closing shows in Florida, sort of morphing into something new and different, opening up these theme parks. This time last year, nobody thought anything was wrong with Ringling. I mean, maybe, I think they announced mid-January. But before the announcement, nobody was guessing that was going to happen.
No.
It really rocked the community. And I want to put out there that Cirque du Soleil is not doing well. We don't know this for sure. This is speculation. You know, we've heard it from at least one credible source. But when you think about it, I don't think they're doing well. Here are some reasons why. To buy Cirque du Soleil, the companies that bought them raised a lot of money, a lot of debt. And the way you do that is you raise money from a bank or from investors, and you say, if we don't pay it back, we have this company that you can have instead. The company is the collateral, the same way a house is a collateral for a mortgage. And then they use that money to try to, you know, jumpstart what Cirque du Soleil can do. You know, you got all this new cash infusion. Look at all these new projects you can do. And Daniel Lamar has already said they're doing tons of new projects and have sped up the pace of creation like two or threefold. And I just don't think it makes... I think they're spending a lot of money, but I don't think they're making a lot of money.
Right. And I think last podcast I said, if you do so many things at one time, you're not really good at any one thing.
Sure.
You know, and I feel like that's... Like they bought Blue Man Group, which... That, to me, makes sense.
But that's still a $60 million purchase, you know, so that's money they've spent. True. That's going to take a while for them to remake that money back. So it's another example, you know, that's $60 million. Didn't come out of nowhere, you know.
No.
That's now debt until it's, you know, or a loss until they make back that money.
And, like, to clarify, doing well versus not doing well is still, you know, millions and millions and millions of dollars that they're probably getting every year in revenue. But, like, is it enough to cover all of their...
Costs.
Current costs.
Yeah, when we say doing well, we don't mean, like, is it liked? Are shows open? Do people have jobs? We mean, if you were to look at their books financially and look at it as a business, is it a healthy business? Does the business exist? Yes. But Ringling existed a year ago. Big Apple existed 4 years ago. But those things, if you looked at them, you wouldn't have described them as healthy businesses, even though they had shows and good reviews and people were buying tickets. Mm-hmm. You know, like, that's sort of a separate... thing.
Yes.
Well, that's enough speculation for us. Let's call up Brett Derby.
Okay, great.
From Columbia Business School, now working for Bain & Company.
Who's much smarter than we are.
Brett, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
For sure. It's great to hear from you guys. How's everything going?
It's going good in New York. Are you out in Los Angeles right now?
Yes, I am. Sunny skies definitely do not have the chill that you all do.
Oh, man.
Jelly.
I am Jelly. It's freezing here. Brett, would you mind just explaining to people a little bit about how we know each other and what being a management consultant is and how you approach looking at business?
Sure. So we had the fortune of meeting while I was in business school, getting an MBA at Columbia. Happened to be actually one of my favorite classes while I was in business school. Essentially took people from all over the Columbia University, not just the business school itself, and really helped bring ideas to fruition. So helped you essentially put your idea down on paper and give you a platform on which to turn into a reality. Happened to meet Josh and Lindsay during the class and really was kind of fell in love with their idea for Hideaway Circus and everything behind it. Obviously, I've seen the trends as a consumer myself within entertainment, live entertainment, and, you know, felt like two people that were extremely passionate about that industry and had a great idea. So since then, have been helping in any aspect that I can, just providing a different perspective to things. Obviously, they have the creative genius and any bit that I can, leveraging, you know, what I've learned at Bain & Company. So
as a management consultant. Oh, sorry. You keep going, Brett.
Okay. Did you have a question?
Oh, no. What I was going to say is that when we started the class, Josh was like, we're not going to find a partner. There's no way.
There's no way we're going to get circus. It's too
No one's going to get circus. And then I was like, you know, have an open mind. And our professor was like, have an open mind. And then we got an email from, you know, Brett. And I was like, we should just meet with him, like, have an open mind. And we met
this
with...
This is too weird.
We met with Brett. And then Josh was like, oh my God, Brett's amazing. Like, he's so smart. He has to be on our team. Yeah. And I was like, I told you. And now you've been a part of kind of helping shape Hideaway ever since.
Yes, I still remember that day we all met in the coffee shop.
Yeah. So, thank God.
Also, would you just quickly explain, like, what you do today? I know you, like, go and you go into industries, you look at troubled business, sort of look at what's going on and give recommendations on how to fix them. Is that sort of an accurate assessment of that?
Yeah, our work is actually pretty broad. So it covers a number of different things, but essentially companies of varying sizes will hire Bain & Company to come in and help them solve some of their most complex problems that they're trying to overcome. So whether that be launching a new product in an industry that they don't have much experience in, or a new market, maybe helping them kind of cut some costs just because they need to reinvest that money in areas of growth within the company. And then to your point that you mentioned, we also work alongside investors looking at different businesses that they find attractive and trying to help them understand if we would recommend that industry and that particular company as an investment that they make.
Great. So why don't we jump into some circus questions?
Have you ever looked at a circus company or like a theatrical company? Has any investor ever been like, what's that about?
To be honest, I have not, aside from just working with the two of you, which I feel like has been enough glimpse into the circus industry itself.
Yeah, you know probably more than anyone at Bain.
Yeah, you're the Bain circus expert. As we talked about a little bit earlier in the podcast, we suspect Cirque du Soleil might not be in the best financial health. You know, it's speculation, but I'm wondering if you can shed a little bit of light on why a company like TPG and Fossen Group, who are these sort of investment firms, would want to buy a company like Cirque du Soleil in the first place, and how they would make money off of a company like Cirque du Soleil.
Sure. So as with any private equity investment, typically what they're looking for is any company that really has a very strong market position and really a sustainable advantage. So when you think about Cirque du Soleil, kind of preeminent in live entertainment space, almost a household name, at least here in the States. And so definitely have a strong brand, pretty loyal customer base, very differentiated product compared to really any other form of live entertainment. And so that's what you're really looking for, a market leader and really a company that will continue to kind of support continued revenue. And if not, you know, a platform for growth. So I think another thing that you really want to look at in an investment is, can this company continue to grow? What are those avenues for growth? You know, how much am I going to have to invest in that growth versus is it very natural? So, for example, have they launched shows in another country, which would be fairly to do, or do we need to create an entirely new type of entertainment under the Cirque du Soleil name?
So
that's probably why they bought Blue Man Group.
Yeah, exactly. How do they like afford to buy a company like Cirque du Soleil? Like, it's billions of dollars, I think, right? Is it all just cash they have, or is it loans from a bank? How does that generally work?
Sure. So it's a mix of all the above. So I think most recently when I looked at TPG, they had over $70 billion in management. And so really what that is they've gone out to a number of largely institutional investors. So think of pension funds, the California Pension Fund being one of the largest in the U.S. And they have billions as well under management. And really what they're looking to do is diversify their holdings. So private equity is a pretty attractive space right now to invest your money. Some of the leading returns, especially relative to hedge funds. And so what they essentially do is will commit their funds to TPG or other investors, and then TPG will go out and invest that in companies like Cirque. So when they purchase Cirque and any other company for that matter, what they will do, it's usually a mix of that money that they have under management, which will be called the equity. And that's essentially a cash check. And then they will also go out and raise funds from a bank. So I think the deal for Cirque was anywhere from $1 to $2 billion. And so you would imagine a percentage of that is going to be an equity, but then a far greater percentage of that is going to be in debt, which will come from different banks. And so that's what you tend to hear associated with private equity. Is they're very levered businesses, and levered being taking on a lot of debt that they then have to pay down over time.
So, you know, from what we've heard speculating, it seems like it was, like you said, maybe $1.2 billion, $1.3 billion. And if a lot of that is debt, when do they have to like pay that off? Like, is it, you know, expensive debt or cheap debt? How does that all work?
Sure. So from a high level, without getting very specific, they're having to make quarterly kind of regular payments on the interest of that debt, which can tend to be quite high, right? So if you think about Cirque's model before they were purchased by TPG, they didn't have near the debt that they do now. And so those interest payments are a lot higher than would be in the past. And so they're having to dedicate however much of their revenue to pay off that interest. And then kind of at a given point in time, all of that, the principal of that will come due. And that's when the bigger payment is. But typically in these type of arrangements, that is pushed, 5 to 10 years down the road. And so it's largely just those regular interest payments that will be a burden.
Are those payments that Cirque du Soleil has to make and is on the line for, or is that payments that the like Fossen Group and TPG who own them have to make?
No, so it is all on Cirque to pay. So it's on their balance sheet, and officially it is Cirque's debt.
What an interesting position for Cirque du Soleil to be in, to have all this debt on them. What happens in this scenario if, they're just not making enough money to pay that debt back, or they're making a little bit money or just breaking even?
Yeah, well, if I back up just for a second, so usually this is all modeled out, right? So any investor like TPG has done this many times over and been quite successful with it. And that's how they continue to raise funds from these institutional investors. So they'll have looked at how much they predict Cirque will make in any given year, and then how much they can afford, how much debt they can take out and still be able to afford. So with that said, certainly it makes the company, it places more onus and accountability on them. To really kind of make sure that they can pay off those interest payments. But it is also done with the understanding that this money is being taken out in order to really help the company grow further. And so that, I think, as you alluded to, right, they recently purchased Blue Man Group, which is yet another aspect of the live entertainment space that they continue to build on. And so really it's not just kind of placing a burden on the company, but methodically allocating all of their capital in a very strategic way.
So is there any reason on which they'd want to, as they've heard from rumors, unload Cirque du Soleil? Is there a scenario where maybe their projections are on the lower end of the spectrum? What are the options for a company like this? Or if it's positive, like what is the ultimate end goal? Like to sell it again in 15 years or just to sort of be sitting on this cash cow in best case scenario?
You know, I can't speak specifically to what TPG's kind of investment thesis or horizon is, but typically in private equity, what you'll see is holding any company for 5 to 7 years. And so what that does is that allows you really a meaningful amount of time to actually grow the company. So first, get in there, really understand what is going on under the belt, how you can change things, how you can redeploy some of your capital to really grow the business, and then do so in a very smart manner. And then in 5 years, ideally, the business is in a much better position than when you bought it, and you can sell it. So you can either sell it to another company to which this would look like an attractive business. Perhaps they want to get into an entertainment space or kind of add this to their portfolio of offerings. You also see businesses go public. And so that's certainly a route that TPG could take with Circ as well. It all just depends on how the company is performing at that 5 year kind of time horizon and what they've committed to their investors, right? So whenever they go out and raise money, they will tell investors, we're going to hold this money for anywhere from 5 to 7 years. And then the investors at that time will expect their money back plus any returns that they've received on that.
Well, so what happens in the scenario where it just performs poorly? Maybe not even the fault of the company. It could just be, you know, industry, just general changes in the industry. I mean, surely for every hit they have, they must have, you know, examples of losses and or investment choices.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, just one thing and piece of context, the difference between private equity and venture capital is that private equity is really trying to look at stable businesses and minimize their risk. And so that's different from venture capital, where it's oftentimes you're investing in 10 businesses, and as long as one is a home run, then that accounts for all your other investments, even if they go to zero. But private equity, you essentially want a bunch of doubles and singles, and so really looking to minimize risk. So, you know, that said, there are certainly investments that do not pay off or perhaps just don't grow to the extent that you thought they would. But because of that commitment to your investors, unless you're able to work with your investors and continue to extend that time horizon so you can hold the business, if you think that you can turn it around with just more time, you'll likely sell it. And you may sell it at the same price that you originally acquired it for, or for even less sometimes, just depending on how they're performing.
So if they sold it for less, who is on the... So is Cirque du Soleil still on the hook for that difference in any debt left over?
So that will typically be it'll be split kind of between the private equity firm as well as the company itself. So Cirque will always have that debt on their balance sheet. And then basically, I think a lot of where you might see the impact would be in the value of the equity that TPG and the Chinese investment firms have in Cirque. So that, think of it almost as a home, right? So when you purchase a home, you place a 20% deposit on the home. That's your cash in it. And then the rest you're taking out in a mortgage. If the house increases in price, then you're actually able to capture all of that increase. But if it goes down, then the value of that 20% that you originally put on the house is kind of quickly diminishing, right? The amount that you took out in that mortgage will always be the same.
Right. Well, that was, you know, informative for me, at least.
But that's also probably why they're doing the amusement park.
Well, they're doing amusement park.
Because it's...
an NFL experience. These are all sort of new growth avenues.
Right. Within the entertainment market.
Exactly. So, I mean... Look, Cirque is a great business, great brand, and have pretty loyal customers. And they've had millions and millions of customers over time. So think of all that data that they have, much like one day you might have at Hideaway, right? They have a lot of great customers who are very interested in whatever shows you may be offering. And so what else can you sell those customers? How else can you entertain them and leverage that? And so that's really kind of what TPG is working closely with management to do. So whether that be buying Blue Man Group, expanding into amusement parks, this NFL experience, expanding into China, all different types of avenues that they can take. And, you know, they're very disciplined investors. And so they can bring that element to Cirque, allow them to continue to be the creative experts that they are and really try to grow the business. And so I know you mentioned they may be closing some shows, and perhaps they're just kind of going to take that investment and put it elsewhere in some of these other experiences so they can really diversify the portfolio.
What I like, something that Josh and I talked about that, you know, is still like, I guess, a thing for a question, maybe not a question, but a thought for me, is that if there is, because they're doing so many things right now, it feels like they're not doing anything really well, to put it, you know, harshly. And is there like the scenario where they almost diversify too much with like trying to go into so many avenues of the entertainment field that then they all kind of are hurt by the fact that they're going into so many different places
for business.
Yeah. And then because of that, the brand starts to diminish, because the original thing that has such brand recognition and loyalty is dwindling. It's not really a question, yeah. But
I mean, these are all great concepts, right? That we cover in any discussion with any of our clients. And I think are kind of fundamental in business school even. But when you think about growing your business and, you know, thinking about putting your brand on a different product, you always run that risk that if it's not to the standards upon which you've built your original offering, you can dilute that brand. And so you certainly, you run that risk anytime you enter something new. But, you know, you also have that opportunity to continue to build an even better experience for your customers. And so, you know, I think it's just really balancing that expansion with, as you mentioned, Josh, the focus. I think every business that continues to be a challenge is just really being focused on kind of the three or four key things that they want to accomplish in any given year. And as you start to put more on your plate, even just as individuals ourselves, it's really hard for us to perform at our best as we're trying to juggle, you know, 10 to 12 balls in the air.
No pun intended, right?
Little circus reference. Though it does make sense if as a private equity company, your goal is to sell the company in like 5 to 7 years.
With a greater value.
The fact that they already bought Blue Man Group and then they are doing the NFL thing and this theme park, like they definitely are growing the company and ideally setting it up for someone to buy it in like the next 3 years.
Yeah. Well, and what you'll tend to see is, so whenever you're purchased, like a liquidity event like this, right, where a guy decides that he wants to sell his majority share to someone, it's essentially signaling a new chapter in Cirque's history. Right. And so TPG has come in, you know, obviously they validated that success to date with a very handsome payout and valuation. And then they think that they can do some things differently and they can bring their business expertise and marry that with Cirque's creative expertise and they can grow the business even further. And so in those first couple years of an investment, that's when you're going to see a lot of new things, right? So sometimes you might see some changes in management. You'll see new businesses that are tried out. And that's because a lot of it is done up front. So then over the next, the back half of the investment, you can really iron out the wrinkles. You can really see what's worked, what hasn't, and really push those forward and kind of realize the returns from those.
Well, you're sort of taking all the air out of my pessimism, but...
I was just going to say, I mean, I feel like maybe Cirque... I mean, we came into this conversation, but this is why we called you, Brett. You know, like, Josh and I have an idea of what, from an artistic standpoint, you know, a creative producing standpoint, how it looks. And then you coming from the business aspect, you know, which is TPG. TPG is coming from the business world into the art world. It does kind of... make it look like it's not going so badly.
It makes more sense why they're making these choices.
Yeah. And this is just from an outside. I mean, both of us are outsiders. You guys might be a little bit more plugged in to the industry than I am, but you know, right now it is a pretty critical juncture now that they're about almost 3 years into the investment. And so, you know, you start to actually understand how this investment is going to shake out, you know, what else we can do with it. But it's really always hard to say, with these companies that are taken private that aren't public, there's not that much information out there. But I think what's most telling is kind of what your fan base here thinks of Cirque du Soleil, right? Because they're ultimately the customers. How are they liking the shows? Are they going to the NFL experience? Are they going to any of those other things? Because ultimately, they're just trying to get more bodies into the shows. And that's really what will drive the success of their investment.
Well, Brett, thank you for your insight. I'm sure everybody listening appreciates it. If you've got questions for Brett, you're listening, tweet them at us, shoot us an email. Maybe we'll get Brett back on to answer some.
Hey, you can always email us at hello@hideawaytocircus.com and we can pass it along to Brett. And he'll answer it if
pleasure,
he wants it.
Guys. All the best at Hideaway. Miss
Brett,
you guys.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Brett.
Well, I certainly feel more positive about what Cirque du Soleil is doing after talking to Brett.
Yeah, me too. I think makes sense, right?
It does. I don't like the NFL experience any more than I did before.
But. No, I still don't like it. I still thought it was pretty bad.
One last thing we want to talk about on this episode to do with Cirque du Soleil is that we recently saw that The Guardian, which is a pretty major newspaper in the UK, had one of their critics' press tickets withdrawn. I guess that this critic, Lynn Garner, had given them a bad one-star review on a previous Cirque du Soleil show, I think maybe Alma Luna. And when OVO came into town a couple weeks ago, they offered The Guardian tickets, and then when they heard that this critic was going to be the one taking it, they withdrew the tickets so that the critic wouldn't write a bad review.
That's so shady. It's so shady.
Nobody does that.
No, you can't control what people say about you, and like the second you try to start, you are acting like the president of the United States.
Yep, that's true. Of course, you know, The Guardian didn't take that sitting down. They bought a ticket for that critic anyway, so they sent a different critic, and they sent Lynn Garner, who ended up giving it 2 out of 5 stars instead of her previous 1-star review. But I think it's just an interesting demonstration in like a change of culture, right? I don't know if that really was the culture of Cirque du Soleil before it was corporate and they were really super right about controlling what the message is. Usually it's the kind of thing that people don't really care about too much. We know that reviews from professional critics don't really matter all that much for ticket sales. So kind of an odd thing to do and gives you bad or just weird press, you know?
Yeah, I think it's kind of strange. Also, like, kind of any press is good press, even if they say the show is bad. Most people aren't actually reading the reviews, but they'll say, oh, OVO is here, The Guardian saw it. I don't know if it really affects ticket sales. I think that's a whole other episode, but I think it's pretty shady that they tried to censor kind of who was reviewing the show.
Agreed.
Well, hopefully Cirque du Soleil doesn't censor us.
Yeah, fingers crossed. We'll get a cease and desist letter after this episode. We hope you guys enjoyed it. This is a bit of a deep dive kind of episode we don't usually do.
If you want to learn more about us, you can follow us on Instagram, like us on Facebook, Twitter tweet us, email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, rate us on iTunes, and
so many wonderful things you
did. But I think this was a fun episode for us to do over the break, and we are looking forward to getting back to some more guest interviews.
Some more regular episodes. Yeah. Fingers crossed we'll be pumping out more of these on a regular basis.
Yeah.
Those of you who've been listening can tell that we tend to put out 5 or 6 in a chunk and then don't do any for a couple weeks. So get ready for some 2018 awesome Hideaway podcasts.
Thanks, guys.
Have a good week.